want to ask you to bring what sounds like it was a fascinating conversation to a close. We're going to talk today about the easy yoke, which was Dallas's topic, and I actually want to talk a fair amount today really about Dallas. I expect if you had signed up to come here, how many of you have read something by Dallas or heard something of what Dallas has said? Okay, so I was guessing. For me, there's nobody humanly that has influenced me more, no writings outside of the Bible that have influenced me more than Dallas's work. And so it means a lot to be able to be here and to be able to step in for Dallas and to talk about what it is that Dallas might talk about if he was here. Please do be in prayer for Dallas and his wife, Jane. He is in recovery mode, but it's really difficult. There's going to be fires when you go out. He and I are actually going to, hopefully, God willing, in February, do a conference in Santa Barbara, which is the only place in the world more beautiful than Orange County, except for the Bay Area where I live. All of which are far better places than Chicago, where I used to live, which is a stupid place to live. February 21 through 23 in Santa Barbara, the Willard Center is sponsoring this conference in Dallas's last book, Knowing Christ Today. The last chapter in it, if you've never read it, I bet I've read this chapter 50 times, is called Pastors as Teachers of the Nations. And the kind of heart of that chapter is the idea that what human beings need most is moral and spiritual knowledge. Not just subjective values, but moral and spiritual knowledge. And that if that's going to be available in our world, it's not going to come through UCLA or USC or Stanford. It will come from the church. And Paul has this very remarkable phrase in the New Testament. The old King James Version puts it like this. Paul says, I magnify my office. I magnify my office. And Dallas says, those who are in positions to teach or to lead at a church must come to understand our role to be teachers of the nations, to make available the fact that there is such a thing as moral and spiritual knowledge in our day. And so anyway, we're praying real hard that God will be gracious and Dallas's health will allow him to be there. And I think it could be a very significant and moving event. So just wanted to let you know about that. I want to say a little bit about Dallas. Dallas is probably the smartest guy I know. A lot of you know he teaches philosophy at USC. I never get into an argument with Dallas because I'm afraid he will prove I don't exist. But this idea that Jesus talked about where he says, come to me, those of you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And of course, that's everybody in our world. But he spoke that particularly not just to stressed out to people, but actually to people who were burdened by religious life. And he says, take my yoke upon you, for my yoke is easy. And what does that mean for a yoke? Yoke, of course, was an instrument of work. But a yoke made it possible for work to get done that would have been impossible apart from that yoke. And rabbis in Jesus' day would sometimes talk about their understanding of Torah, their way of life, as being their yoke. And so a yoke has to do with a way of life, a rhythm of life, a way of arranging our days. What do I do when I wake up? What do I do while I'm working? What do I do with my money? What do I do with my time? And Jesus says, my yoke is easy. So we're talking about the easy yoke. What does it mean to go through life and not be crushed or burdened? And especially for those of us who are involved in church ministry. Eugene Peterson says, one of the really hard things is to not have the service of God get in the way of our life with God. And that ministry often actually reinforces inattentiveness to God. So how do we find Jesus' easy yoke? I went into church ministry a long time ago. Jim, I thought as you were talking, when I first went to grad school after college, I thought it was going to be a therapist and a clinician. I was talking to Jamin about that on the ride here. I actually got a PhD in clinical psychology. But when I started to see clients, I found out I was a very bad therapist. People would actually get more unhealthy emotionally as I saw them for a longer period of time. And it was draining to me. So I'm very grateful that there's an organization like SIFT to be in partnership with. And at the same time, I started to work at a church and found I love the church. And I love to work at the church. And I felt a calling to preach. But after, 5 or 10 years of doing church ministry, I began to get deeply frustrated. You know, the questions of what does it mean to be human? And how do people change? Why is change so hard? Why doesn't change happen more often in the church, if we're honest about it? You know, I think often in the church, we're pretty good if somebody comes in and they're from a real unchurched background and they have a lot of ungodly habits that are kind of on the surface, profanity or certain sexual sins or so on. And they meet Jesus and we're able to teach them about worship and they begin to learn the Bible. And so there'll be change. But then after a while, I think a lot of our churches wrestle with this. People feel like the change process kind of stalls out. And when you look at what the Bible says about the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, and peace, people don't seem to be progressively being transformed into more loving, joyful people. I will tell sometimes about the first church that I worked at, the Baptist church. We had a guy I'll call Hank, and he was a cranky guy. He had been a cranky young man in the church once, and this was 50 years later, and he was now a cranky old man. He was not a happy person. He did not love people. He wasn't winsome. He was just kind of a difficult guy to be around. We had a deacon. That church was governed by deacons. And this is a celebrated moment one time. This deacon asked him once, "Hank, are you happy?" And Hank thought about it and then said yes. And then this deacon said to him, "Well, tell your face." But apparently he never told his face. And what was striking as I began to think about that was that Hank did church the way that we told people to do church. He attended on a regular basis. He gave money. He was involved in a Bible study. He volunteered. He avoided certain scandalous sins. But here's the thing. He was not being transformed into a joyful, loving, winsome person. But what was more disturbing was nobody expected him to be transformed into a more loving, joyful, winsome person. Nobody said, "We need to bring in a church consultant, or we need to find a conference someplace to help us address this terrible problem. There's this guy in our midst, and he's doing church the way that we tell people to do church. He's coming to services and going to classes, and he has a quiet time, and he volunteers, and he gives money. But he is not you know, what Paul talked about. I beseech you by the mercies of God, present your bodies as living sacrifices. Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Or writing to the church at Galatia, my dear brothers and sisters, for whom I am in the pains of childbirth until Christ be formed in you. You know, it just began to be troubling that if we're honest about it, people attend services, they do church, and yet that transformation process that Paul talks about is not happening. And honestly, we're kind of not expecting it to happen. And what will often happen, sometimes put it like this, if genuine transformation doesn't take place, we will settle for what might be called pseudo-transformation. There was a guy named James Dunn who wrote a commentary on Romans years ago. And he talked about how in the first century of the church, the great majority of rabbinic attention, teaching and so on, went to three areas of the law: dietary laws, circumcision, and Sabbath keeping. And he asked, now why did they spend so much time on those three areas of the law? Because everybody knew that wasn't the heart of the law. The heart of the law, Deuteronomy 6:4, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Him shall you love with all your soul and heart and strength. So why did they spend all their time talking about dietary laws, Sabbath keeping, and circumcision? And he said, it's because of this tendency that all groups have to want to be exclusive. All groups tend to want to know who's inside our group and who's outside our group. So they all tend to develop what sociologists call boundary markers, highly visible, relatively superficial means through vocabulary or habits or style of dress or so to distinguish who's inside the group versus who's outside the group. Boundary markers, identity markers. All groups tend to have them. For example, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area now. If it was in the 60s and you were driving and somebody pulled up next to you and they were driving a Volkswagen van and it was plastered with bumper stickers that say, make love, not war. And it featured, you know, long string beads, and the driver had long hair and granny glasses and was barefoot. You would know you were driving next to a hippie. Why? Because he's got all the boundary markers. If it was the 80s and the driver was driving a BMW and had on Gucci shoes and carefully moosed hair and a Rolex watch and was on his way to a wine and brie tasting party, you would know you were driving next to a yuppie. Because you've got all the boundary markers. All groups tend to have these boundaries. How do we know who's inside the group and who's outside the group? All groups tend to have them. Bikers have them. What's a biker's favorite color? What's a biker's favorite fabric? Leather. What's a biker's favorite beverage? Beer. You all knew that one. What's a biker's favorite kind of woman? Biker chick. Somebody knows that one. Yeah. Okay. Boundary markers. Highly visible, relatively superficial ways of knowing who's inside the group versus who's outside the group. Now, come back to the first century. Why is it that that the religious leaders tended to spend all their time, a vast majority of time, focusing on Sabbath keeping, circumcision, and dietary laws? Those were the boundary markers. See, the big question was, who is inside and who is outside the people of God? If you take faith seriously, you want to know. Now, when theology gets kind of liberal or vague enough, that question ceases to be important. But generally, if people take the faith really important, then they want to know, how do you know who's in and who's out of the people of God? And where people are not being authentically transformed, where they are not progressively actually becoming more loving and more joyful, if people are not experiencing authentic transformation, then faith will deteriorate into pseudo-transformation, into a search for boundary markers that serve to distinguish who is inside versus who is outside the people of God. In the first century, it was dietary laws, Sabbath keeping, and circumcision. And over the years, across cultures, across centuries, it becomes different sets of behaviors. I grew up in a great church. I was real grateful for it. I am real grateful for it. But honestly, it was a church where the senior pastor, as long as the church was growing and the doctrine sounded orthodox, the senior pastor could have been consumed by pride and lovelessness. And as long as the church was growing and the preaching sounded orthodox, he could have kept his job. But if one time after the service he would have smoked a cigarette in the parking lot, he would have been fired immediately. Why? Nobody would have said that smoking a cigarette was a worse sin than pride and lovelessness. None of us would have. So why would he have been fired over that one piece of behavior? Because in our church, that was the boundary marker. That's one of the ways that we told who is inside and who's outside the people of God. And you just mark this down. I bet if we had time to talk about this, whatever your tradition, you would be able to name from that tradition. What were the boundary markers? This is the great damage of legalism. This is why legalism is simultaneously exhausting and trivial. And why it makes the faith look noxious to people on the outside and impossible to people on the inside. That's legalism. Another statement from Dallas. Spirituality, wrongly understood or pursued, is a major source of human misery and rebellion against God. Spirituality, wrongly understood or pursued, is a major source of human misery and rebellion against God. Now, when people would come to Jesus with that question, how do you know who's in, who's out? What's at the core of faith, of spirituality? He does not focus on the boundaries, who's in, who's out. His response is, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. He focuses on what's at the center and not what is at the boundaries. What transformation is about is becoming a person who is pervaded by the fruit of the Spirit, and most especially by love. That's spiritual maturity. Now, when we get wrong about what spiritual maturity looks like, that's when it becomes this exhausting, trivial game. And we start to look at behaviors. And those behaviors may be very good things in themselves. Sabbath is a real good thing in itself. Reading the Bible is a real good thing in itself. But when I turn it into a boundary marker, when it becomes the litmus test to know who's in, who's out, it starts to breed comparison and judgmentalism and legalism. Spirituality, wrongly understood or pursued, is a major source of human misery and rebellion against God. And with Jesus, and his followers get this. The Apostle Paul says, I might speak in the tongues of men and of angels. I might have enough faith to move mountains. I might give all my possessions away. But if I have not what? If I have not love, I'm nothing. Okay? So the easy yoke begins with the right understanding. The right understanding of spiritual life. The right understanding is that the aim is love. It's just love. One of the great problems that a lot of us in the church have is that we measure spiritual maturity by devotional activities. We measure spiritual maturity by devotional activities. And so we'll want to know how many people are praying how long, or reading the Bible how long, or in how many small groups. Here's the problem with that. In Jesus' day, if you measured spiritual maturity by devotional activities, who would come out on top? Pharisees. We have to find a way to gauge spiritual maturity so that the Pharisees don't win. Or else we'll produce Pharisees. We have to get real clear what's a means and what's an end. For example, used to be involved at a church where journaling was like a really big deal. And my wife hates to journal. She'll feel tremendously guilty because every once in a while she'll buy a journal and then make one entry. And then it will be weeks, months, years before, you know, she makes another entry. Just out of curiosity, show of hands. You won't see most of these people again for a long time, if ever. Mass confession. If you're just really honest about it, how many of you would say, I don't really like to journal? Raise your hands real high, would you? Keep them up for a moment. Now just look around the room for a minute. And this is the spiritual leadership of Orange County. It is no wonder Orange County is going to hell. That should not be a surprise. Okay? This may be the whole reason why God brought you here today. This thought right here. Jesus never journaled. You ever think about that before? Like Moses, Elijah, Esther, all kinds of people loved God, prayed, sought to, you know, live in God's power, in the reality of His kingdom, but they never went to the stationery store and bought a little leather-bound book and wrote. Now, if journaling helps you, and like for me sometimes, especially in times of great pain, it does. If it helps you, then do it. If it doesn't help you, then don't do it. Whatever you do, don't feel guilty about how much you're journaling. You have more important things to feel guilty about. And I really do mean that. Again, what will happen is, because spirituality wrongly understood or pursued is a major source of human misery and rebellion against God, we start defining our aliveness before God, our spiritual health, by something we call our walk, or how our devotional life is going. How regular are my journal entries? And I might have a heart filled with pride. There may be people starving to death around the world, and I don't think about them, I don't care about them, I don't pray for them, I don't give to them, and I don't feel guilty about that. But I feel guilty about how many journal entries I have. You see what I'm saying? So the easy yoke begins by understanding we're not called to something called a spiritual life. We're just called to life. We're just called to life. And then I'll tell you about the most, and nothing I talk about today is original with me. And again, Dallas has been so influential, you know, just so you all know, I don't even know anymore how many ideas came from him. But if you just attribute most all of them to him, and he would say, you know, they're not original with him. People, wise people have thought about this stuff for a long time. Most helpful distinction that I learned from Dallas, again, it goes way back, around the easy yoke, around spiritual formation. And then I'll talk about some of these, particularly for us in pastoral ministry, is there's a tremendous difference between training to do something versus trying to do something. There's a tremendous difference between training to do something versus trying to do something. So, if you think, for instance, about Paul's statement, 1 Corinthians 9:24 to 27, where he uses the analogy of a race. Don't you know, all the runners who compete in a race go into strict training, the NIV says. They do it. They do what? They go into strict training to win a perishable wreath. We do it. We do what? We go into strict training to win an imperishable wreath. So let's talk for a moment about the whole idea of training versus trying. Let's just start with physical transformation. Because transformation of any sort, significant transformation of any sort, generally involves training, not just trying. Physical transformation. Years ago, my wife rented a Sylvester Stallone video. It's a movie. It's not a good movie. I don't recommend it. It's called Cliffhanger. I don't know if any of you ever saw it. It's mostly in the mountains and it's real cold. Everybody's wearing these parkas and heavy jackets, except for Sylvester Stallone, who could not keep his shirt on. And all through this movie, you know, he has no shirt. And finally, like the fifth time this happens, he is dangling from a rope in the snow-covered mountains, deltoids and biceps bulging and rippling off the screen. And my wife looked at him, and then she looked over at me. And then she looked at him and looked back at me, it's a true story, and kind of shook her head and said, you know, I've just never been attracted to well-built men. And I looked for the compliment that I knew was lurking somewhere beneath the surface, but it lurked too deep and I could never find it. So let's just talk for a moment about training when it comes to the physical realm. Let's take running as Paul's example, running in a race. How many of you could leave this room and run, not walk, run every step of a marathon right now today? Raise your hands. Okay, a couple of people. This is a non-journaling, out-of-shape, hell-bound group. Yeah. Second question. How many of you, again, right now today, could go out of here and run every step of a marathon right now if you were to try really, really, really hard? Not many more. Now, my guess is almost every one of us in this room, if you wanted to enough, eventually you would be able to run, not walk, every step of a marathon. What would you have to do first? You have to train. What does it mean to train? To train means I arrange my life around those activities through which I am able to do what I cannot now do by direct effort. Okay, to train means I arrange my life around those activities through which I receive power to do what I cannot now do by direct effort. One more time. To train means I arrange my life around those activities that enable me, through which I receive power to do what I cannot now do by direct effort. And as a general rule, transformation in any sphere of life will involve training, not just trying. This is true when it comes to physical transformation. This is true when it comes to intellectual transformation. If I want to learn a language, there are certain activities that will involve my body. I'll have to cause myself to look at a new alphabet until it becomes part of my mental landscape. I'll have to hear new sounds and repeat them. Those are things I do with my body that enable me to do what I cannot now do by direct effort. This is true for musical transformation. If you want to play Bach in front of this whole group of folks on a piano, well, then the way you do that is you train. You start taking lessons. You sit down and you practice scales. People will sometimes think that's the hard way to play Bach. No, that's not. That's the easy way to play Bach. You know what the hard way is? Never, ever, ever practice. Wait till the crowd gathers and then sit down and try really hard to play Bach. That's the hard way. Okay? This idea is no less true when it comes to spiritual life. This is precisely why Paul says they do it. They enter into strict training to win a perishable wreath. We do it. We enter into training to win an imperishable wreath. This is why Jesus said in Luke 6:40, no disciple is above the master, but every disciple, when fully trained, will be like the master. This is why Paul, when he's writing to Timothy, 1 Timothy 4:7, says, train yourself unto godliness. Okay? So the easy yoke involves a life of training, not just trying to be like Jesus. A life of wise training. Now, I got to stop there. And hopefully we'll have time to do a few questions, you know, eventually. I have to stop there again. I wish Nancy, my wife, was here because she is a very helpful counterbalance for me. One of the things you'll talk about is that so often people who write or speak on spiritual formation are introverted, introspective white males, and that just messes up what gets said, so that if you're not somebody like that, you feel left out. And another thing that Nancy hates is the word training. When I talk about training versus trying, because it sounds, you know, militaristic and oppressive and, you know, no fun. So let me say a little bit about what training or spiritual disciplines. This gets us into the idea of spiritual disciplines. A few things that they are not, because they're widely misunderstood. Spiritual disciplines, obviously connected to the idea of being a disciple, the easy yoke. Spiritual discipline is not a barometer of your spiritual growth. Okay? A lot of times people think that a spiritually mature person is someone who does a lot of disciplines. That's not the case. If you try to turn the practice of disciplines into the measure of someone's devotion or spirituality, then you make a discipline into a boundary marker. Okay? They are a means. They are not the end. It's very much like if I'm a basketball player, I want to be able to make a free throw when the game is on the line. Probably that means I'm going to have to practice free throws. Probably. But I don't get any credit for practicing free throws. Okay? That's just a means to an end so that in the moment I can do what needs to be done. Spiritual disciplines are just a means to an end so that when life is happening, I can do the right thing at the right time in the right way. And if they don't help you to receive the power to live with love and joy and peace, then you do not need to practice them. That's why, like, if journaling helps you, by all means do it. If it's a means to an end of that kind of life, if not, you don't have to do it. Spiritual disciplines are also not necessarily something that is unpleasant. A lot of times we get this idea. But for example, in the Bible, we are commanded to be joyful. Now, see, here's the problem. So many folks in our churches, when we talk about that, they walk out of church saying to themselves, I got to try really hard to be more joyful. We kill people with this. And then they just get frustrated because it doesn't work any better than trying really hard to run a marathon or trying really hard to play box. We reduce people to willpower. We may talk about grace, but we end up talking about how to be saved by grace, by which we mean how to get into heaven after you die by grace. But we don't actually teach people or learn ourselves, how do I live by grace? And if you want to think of it this way, training or spiritual disciplines are simply the means by which I live by grace. John Wesley used to talk about means of grace. So let's say that my problem is that I struggle with the sin of joylessness. Okay, the Bible commands in quite a few places, rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say rejoice. So joylessness is a sin. It's a real serious sin. But if I just respond by saying, I'll try harder to be more joyful, that's not going to work. So what do I do? Well, I train for joy. How do you train for joy? Do you ever notice when you read through the Old Testament how many holidays there are in the Old Testament? How often people would go to these gatherings. Read through Deuteronomy 14 sometime. And it talks about one of the feasts. And it says people are to come together and eat great food. And it actually says in Deuteronomy 14, you read through it, sell whatever you have, and if you are not able to get to the place that I shall prescribe, that would be Jerusalem, then sell what you have and buy food and wine or strong drink. And eat and drink. We did not read that passage of the Bible in the Baptist church where I grew up. Now, what's that about? Because, you know, obviously the abuse of alcohol is a massive problem in our society. Well, it's training people for joy. It is training people for joy. That's why Richard Foster, who wrote this book, Celebration of Discipline. By the way, when I first heard about that book, it came out now 30 some years ago. When I first heard about it, I hated that book, Celebration of Discipline, because I felt like I already know there's two disciplines, reading the Bible and praying, and I don't do them as much as I'm supposed to. And I feel guilty about that. So now you're going to tell me there's like 10 more disciplines that I'm supposed to do and I can't feel good about my spiritual life till I've mastered all of them, and I hated it. And what changed my life was when I was frustrated by my own lack of transformation, and it was Dallas's book, The Spirit of the Disciplines. Outside the Bible has changed me more than anything else. And in the introduction of that book, Dallas writes, my thesis is this, that authentic transformation is possible if we are willing to arrange our lives around those practices Jesus engaged in to receive power and life from His Father. And when I read those words, I was on a plane ride. I could tell you the chair I was sitting in on that plane. I started to cry. Authentic transformation is really possible if we're willing to do one thing, to take Jesus seriously as the master of life and arrange our lives around those practices Jesus engaged in to be in continual fellowship with, to be constantly receiving power and life from His Father. See, another misconception when it comes to spiritual practices is that they are tools or techniques and somehow opposed to grace. One of the great problems that we have with grace in our day is we have shrunk grace down into just the forgiveness of sins. So that when a lot of people hear grace, all they think of is being forgiven. Now, of course, grace includes the forgiveness of sins, but grace is much more than the forgiveness of sins. God was gracious way before anybody ever sinned. Creation is an act of grace. And mostly we experience grace as God's power in us to do what we could not. And we were meant to run on grace. We were meant to live on grace. To wake up in the morning and have the first moment not be an oppressive burden. How am I ever going to get through this day? But a gift, because God is present right here, of His grace and sufficiency. I love how Dallas says this. Dallas says, saints burn more grace than sinners ever could. Saints burn grace like 747s burn jet fuel. See, we think that it's sinners who stand in need of grace, and we are exactly wrong. Of course they do, but saints need way more grace than sinners do because they have learned to run on grace. And if somebody is misusing the idea of spiritual practices or spiritual disciplines, where they just think of it as a technique that they can use on their own, then the right thing, of course, is not to dismiss the idea, but learn how to use it properly so that it becomes a receiver of grace from one moment to the next. So, for example, let's say that you struggle with joylessness. I believe joylessness is a huge problem in the church. What I want to do in the moments that remain in this talk, and then a little Q&A if we can, is talk about the easy yoke, particularly for those of us in ministry. So now, if you're involved in church ministry, pastor, church leadership position, maybe a spouse, I sometimes think that churches are harder on spouses of church leaders than they are on church leaders. So let's just talk about this. I believe the easy yoke for people in church ministry begins with joy. The easy yoke for people in church ministry begins in joy. Several years ago, I had a sabbatical, first sabbatical I have ever had, and it was wonderful. Somebody told me it's going to take you a long time to unplug from your church. It did not. It took me like 5 minutes to unplug from my church. And I loved it. I felt this just sense of peace and freedom. And so as part of that sabbatical, I met with Dallas for a while. And one of my questions was, I really would like to get better at having our church be a place of spiritual transformation, like where people are actually getting more loving and joyful. So what's the first thing I should do? And I thought he would say, have everybody read this book, have everybody start this prayer program, you know, have everybody join. And he's quite amazing in the things that will come out of him. His immediate response was, you must arrange your life so that you are experiencing deep contentment, joy, and confidence in your everyday life with God. You must arrange your life so that you are experiencing deep contentment, joy, confidence in your everyday life with God. Because the biggest thing that you will reproduce in your church is you in your life. And I love what Jim said at the beginning of talking for a while about our lives and our souls when we gather together. And I just want to say, from a kingdom perspective, that is intrinsically, irretrievably connected with the kind of church that we create. Because if there's a gap between the gospel I preach and the gospel I live, everybody's going to believe the gospel I live. You know, I proclaim what I really believe by the way that I live. And in my church, the people who are closest to me, that's what they will experience. And that's what they will be drawn to live. Because they'll know that I will reward that. And then it will ripple out from there. And I believe, personal opinion, churches are becoming harder places for people who lead them, for pastors, to live in contentment. I remember talking with Dallas a while ago, and he was saying when he was a boy, he grew up in rural Missouri, he doesn't remember as a boy people ever asking the question, is this pastor successful? He said there were churches, and they always knew some pastors were a little better suited for their work than others. But churches were around. Pastors kind of came and went. It was a place where people gathered to try to love and learn. But it wasn't a relevant category to ask of the pastor, is the pastor having a successful career? Let me ask all of you, is that still true? I think the burden on people in church ministry to be successful, to build something that looks impressive, to be compared to other people, you know, for a whole variety of reasons. That is our culture. You know, through mass communications, through the internet, podcasts. I sometimes envy people from previous centuries because nobody ever went up to a pastor in 16th century Germany and said, you know, I've been listening to this series by Martin Luther, and man, does he give it to the Pope. How come you never do that in your sermons around here? You know, they lived in a different world. So it's possible for us in the church to think it's somebody else's job to make me happy. My elders must take care of me. The leaders in our church must really get committed so the church can grow, so it looks impressive, and then I can be happy. My spouse must make me happy. No, you must arrange your day so that you experience total confidence, joy, contentment in your everyday experience. Now, let's say you wrestle with joylessness. Then it may be what you need to do. If you're going to train for joy, see, if you're going to train, then you have to ask. This is real, real important when we think about spiritual disciplines. What I have to do is kind of work backwards and think about what would my life in the kingdom of God look like if I was really being continually transformed by love, joy, peace, patience, and so on. My temperament, what would that look like? And then, what are the sins, temptations, what are the barriers that get in my way? And then, what are the practices? What are the relationships? What are the experiences? Those, at least for me, are three helpful categories that God might use to give me grace to help me grow beyond these patterns of sin and temptation so that I can enter into this kind of life. So let's say that this life is a life of joy, and yet I suffer from the sin of joylessness. What's a practice that might help me enter into that? Well, it could be what Richard Foster actually wrote about as the discipline of celebration. Celebration itself is a spiritual discipline. We often think of disciplines as being these difficult, oppressive, unlikable things, but that's not at all the case. It depends on what you're training for. Now, if you're training to win a marathon, what discipline will you engage in a lot? You'll run. If you're training to win a pie eating contest, what discipline will you engage in a lot? Eating pie. And if you practice eating pie every day for the next year, a year from now, you will be able to eat much more pie than you can today by direct effort. See, a discipline is not, it's not something God gives you gold stars for. And it's not something that's onerous or difficult or hard. And it's not a badge of your spiritual maturity. It's a means to an end. So, if my problem is I'm joyless, but I want a life of joy, then here's what you do. Take one day a week and make it your celebration day. One day a week, wear clothes you love to wear. Eat food you love to eat. Listen to music you love to listen to. Do stuff you love to do. Hang around people you love to hang around who breathe life into you. Because if you're at a church, there will be other people in your life who do not bring joy into you, who suck joy out of you, who are black holes of joy, who are Hoover joy suckers. And on that day, you need to say to them, I can't be around you today. This is my joy day. I'll be around you again tomorrow. Okay? So it may be for you. I'm real serious about this. If you're in church ministry, an enormous problem is the joylessness of church leaders. And the great illusion is when the church is going well enough, I will find joy. Now, you must arrange your life so that you have total contentment, joy, and confidence in your everyday experience. When I'm working on a sermon. When I'm meeting with elders. When people are complaining. See, in the real life stuff. That's about my connection with God. Ministry never has been easy. You know, we get all twisted up because people they disapprove of us or are disappointed in us. Who did Jesus not disappoint? Every human being in his life, Jesus disappointed. But that did not cause him to say, man, maybe I went into the wrong line of work. You know, maybe I should go back and be a carpenter. Okay, so, joy. Second part of the easy yoke, for those of us that are involved in ministry, finding my worth and identity in who I am and not how it's going. And not how it's going. Part of what's involved here is learning to release outcomes. Learning to release outcomes. Tell you another Dallas story. One time he was at our church and he had finished giving a talk. And we were walking out to the parking lot afterwards, and I noticed he was walking along and he was just singing this old hymn. And what struck me was how often in my world, folks I know, including myself, so often when we're done with a talk, the first question is, how'd it go? I'm doing this talk and what I'm living with is, how is it going? How am I doing? Am I doing okay? Is this talk going all right? Am I losing it? Is it not going well? And then, you know, my whole well-being is on the line. And with Dallas, it was like watching a little kid let go of a helium-filled balloon. And it's like, there's the talk. And of course, I want to give the best talk I can. I want it to be helpful to people. I want to learn when I'm not doing it well and how do I get better. And maybe I'm not good at giving talks and that's what I should not do. So I want to learn about all that stuff. But then I don't live under the burden of the outcome. I just let it go. See, that is life in the kingdom. We don't have time to get deeply today into the reality of the kingdom, but the gospel is the invitation to live, not just after I die, but now in the kingdom, the presence and the power of God. And a deep part of what that means is I don't carry the burden of outcomes. And so I learn, how do I let that go? And of course, that's a lifelong process, but it's got to get into my body. So that my emotions no longer ride on, did the talk go great or did the talk go bad? I learn to release outcomes by finding who I am, my worth, and the fact that I'm loved by God. And for me, one of the practices that I constantly need around that one is solitude. Because when I am with people, it's just programmed in my body. I'll read your face. Do you smile at me? Do you nod at me? Are your eyes closed? Are you sleeping while I'm talking? Are you sleeping while, you know? It's just why when I go alone, see, then I can be away. So spiritual discipline, the practice is disrupting the normal patterns that keep us captive. That's what a practice or a discipline is. It's disrupting the normal patterns that keep us captive. And it's generally something I do with my body. Celebration is something I do with my body. Solitude is something I do with my body. And when I go away, it takes a while. It took me a long time to learn how to do this. The main thing in solitude isn't what I do. The main thing isn't, do I pray or do I read or do I meditate? The main thing is what I don't do. What I don't do is interact with people or prop my mind up through some kind of external stimulation. And then I can find out what is there between me and God. And in solitude, I get free from other people's expectations. The spiritual disciplines are always about freedom. They're always about freedom. See, the reason you practice scales is so that you are free to make wonderful music without having to think about which finger goes where. You look at an athlete, the reason that they practice is so in that moment in the game, they are free to make a graceful catch. Disciplines are always just about freedom to live. Another part of the easy yoke, which is related to this one, is the importance of doing nothing. The importance for those of us in ministry, because ministry very often involves doing something. I must regularly do nothing. And this is not primarily a psychological category. I'll say a word about this. And I love the discipline of psychology. It's my own background. Sometimes we talk about self-care, although as though it were an end in itself. And I'm thinking a lot these days about soul. I find it really interesting that the Bible so often talks about the soul when we talk about the self. But you can't get away from that word soul. Think about the difference between being soulish and being selfish. There's a reason why with music we come back to that then sings my soul, my Savior. It's not the same if you say, then sings myself. Because the soul reminds me that I exist before God. My soul belongs to God. Self-care is not something that I just do for myself. My soul is part of a bigger kingdom. And when I do nothing, this is why the Sabbath is so important. This is why the Bible has quite a lot to say about sleep. The Lord gives sleep to those He loves. When I do nothing, then I remember in my body, it is God's work and mind that, and not mind that really matters. When I had moved to Chicago, I worked at Willow Creek Church, been there for about 6 months, and it was a real busy place, and I could tell it was going to be pretty frantic. And so I called Dallas up and described what life was like, and then I asked him, what do I need to do to remain healthy in ministry? And there was a long pause. Never forget this. And then Dallas said, one sentence, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And there was another long pause. And then I said, okay, I got that one. Now, what else do you have? Because I don't have a lot of time and I need to get as much wisdom as I can. And he said, no, there is nothing else. He said, hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. He said, now there's a difference between being busy and being hurried. Being busy is mostly something that involves our bodies. It's having many things to do. Jesus was often busy. Being hurried is a condition of the soul. And you all know about this. When I'm so preoccupied in my mind, I can no longer just be present with you and love you. Just be present with God. And remember, oh yeah. I don't have to worry about the outcome. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And that means there must be large chunks of time when you do nothing. And the way that you find out, you know, so often when it comes to spiritual practices, people just want to know, what am I supposed to do? You know, how many minutes am I supposed to pray? How much of the Bible am I supposed to read? It doesn't work that way. It's very experiential. It will take learning. It will be different for you than for you than for you, because we're at different ages, different temperaments, different wirings, different responsibilities, different temptations. It begins by saying, what does my life look like if I'm living this life? And then what are the barriers that keep me from that? And then how do I arrange my life so that I can enter into that? So doing nothing on a regular basis. And then the last one that I'll mention is last part of the easy yoke for those of us who are in churches is finding the right vision. And I'll say a word about this one, finding the right vision. Somebody asked Dallas one time, why is it so often that pastors, church leaders start well but don't finish well? Why is it so often? You all know about this, know this heartache. People end up in a ditch. Why? And he had an amazing response. It's actually a whole chapter in a little book of his called The Great Omission. He said, anytime there's a great work of God, it will begin with somebody having a great vision. Francis of Assisi. Only it's not a vision of what's Francis going to do. It's a vision of God. And what a glorious being God is. And what an unbelievable gift and privilege. What a lucky person I am to be alive in God's great universe where He's doing this wonderful thing. It begins with that vision. And then out of that vision will grow a desire to do something good for this wonderful God. But then what will happen is there'll be visible results from this. And then what will happen is a bunch of people will see those visible results and they'll begin to say, I want to be a part of that. I want to get in on that. And so they will. And then their focus will shift from the vision to the mission. The focus will shift from the vision of what a good God God is to the mission of what impressive stuff we're all doing together. And then our minds and souls will be dominated by numbers and metrics and goals and methodologies. And we will take on the strain of trying to do too much and bearing the burden of outcomes. And then there will be burnout and fatigue and anger and bitterness. And then eventually there'll be sin. And there'll be the loss of vision. Now, as you look at it throughout history, always this is what happens. There is a vision, but the vision that begins is like Isaiah. What's Isaiah's vision? "And I saw the Lord high and lifted up." That's the vision that matters. You know, we live in a vision-obsessed culture, but even in churches so often, we don't talk about that vision. We talk about the vision of what we want the people in our church to do. That's not the vision that matters. The vision that matters is the vision of what already is. And then when I live in that vision, out of that will come. But I have to keep coming back to that vision. And that's the easy yoke. And the good news is that's available to every one of us. I don't know where your church is. I don't know what it's going through. I don't know what it looks like. Really doesn't matter, because the kingdom doesn't work that way. That's the easy yoke. And I want to finish well. I'm getting closer to the finish every day. Again, joy is such a key thing. I started surfing a couple years ago. And I actually took some friends of mine to go surfing at Cowles Beach and Santa Cruz. And we had surf instructors. And one of them whispered to the other when he saw that. I still think of us, because we went to college together. It's just kind of young guys, not long out of college. The surf instructor said to the other guy, "It must be AARP day at the beach today." And I thought, well, it must not be Big Tip Day at the beach day today. But the joy of the Lord, the easy yoke, is available all the time. And I got to be done real fast. Any question? Anybody got anything real quick? Yeah.
How do you bring this into your staff? How do you encourage?
That's great. Question is, how do I bring this into the staff of the church where I work? And, you know, I hope there can be great conversations about this among churches. One of the things that we do, because it was such a transformative experience for me, staff for the last couple of years, that the main leadership team, have just been reading together the Spirit of the Disciplines. And we will actually go through, there's a section in there in the 8th chapter that talks about some of the primary disciplines of the spiritual life. We'll read through one of those a week, practice them during the week, and then come back together the next week and talk about how did that actually go. So we'll look for different ways of doing this, but it's a constant learning process, and we have a long ways to go at it. Great question. Yeah. Okay. Jim, is it back to you or Bill? We could do it. Anybody else? Any other question? Yeah. Not joyful. Say a word about that. If you have little kids, this is where I think, you know, again, every culture has its own issues. I think the whole concept of quiet time has just killed a bunch of folks, particularly moms of young children. I remember early on when I was at a church, a woman said, she was in her late 20s, "It was easier for me," we were talking about seeking first the kingdom of God. She said, "It was easier for me to do that when I was in college than it is now." And I asked why. She had two small kids. And the only way she had to monitor her devotion to God was, how good's your quiet time? And with three small children, it was like non-existent. They'll do surveys on this kind of stuff. What's your favorite room in the house? It's usually the kitchen or the bedroom, except for moms. Anybody want to guess what a mom's favorite room is? That's exactly right. Why? You can go in there and lock the door and get away from those little, you know, guys. And what never occurred to her was maybe in caring and serving for those little guys, more transformational grace will be poured out onto her life than if she were to memorize the entire book of Deuteronomy. We failed her badly. We have never taught her. So I think, first of all, we need a much clearer picture of spiritual transformation. How does it work and what counts? See, we get this goofy idea of what counts. And then I think for couples and for churches, this is why community is necessary for spiritual life. And as a dad, Nancy and I, you know, we had a commitment that we wanted to be in a marriage where we served together equally. But we still, the number one conflict we had was around division of labor. And part of that had to do with child care. And if I had to do that over, even though we worked at it, I would do more to make time available for her to have space in her own life, to be alone as she needed to be with God in ways that were helpful to her. But I think for any marriage, to talk with each other about what do you need to be moving in that direction. And then for churches, and to say to the elders, here's what I need, here's what my spouse needs. I think a lot of times churches would be willing to help out with that, but we don't necessarily say to them what it is that we need. So, great question. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's a great question. What am I not going to do today? The longer that you're involved in church ministry, that issue only gets harder, never easier. One of the most helpful things for me, because on the Myers-Briggs, I'm a P, if that means anything to you. So, like, I don't like details at all. My wife is a P. We will sometimes say we need a wife. So we actually meet every couple of weeks together with the person who is my administrative assistant at the church, and go through all kinds of calendar items and just say yes or no. And the vast majority is a no. And I found for me that practice is the single most helpful one. And I'd encourage anybody here, doesn't have to be a spouse, doesn't have to be somebody you pick, could be a friend or whatever, but unless you're real good at this, have somebody where every couple of weeks you're sitting down with them and you just walk through. Here's the stuff that I do: message prep, meeting, counseling, outside stuff if there's that, you know, being with the elders. What should I say yes to and what should I say no to? Because part of what I found is I'll get a rhythm straight in one season of life and then something changes. Our kids hit a different age, the church is in a different season, and it's a constantly moving target. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Jim, come on back up.